In Princeton, New Jersey, there are two schools. One is extremely well-known and old, Princeton University. The other institution is of more recent vintage. It is also not nearly so large as Princeton University. It is, however, no less distinguished in its particular field. The second institution is Westminster Choir College. It has very well-known choirs, since Westminster is located about an hour's drive from New York and an hour's drive from Philadelphia. The Westminster choirs have regularly performed over the years with the major symphony orchestras of those two cities. Westminster Choir College, with a few under 500 students, boasts the largest organ department of any school in the world. Westminster Choir College also has a department of church music. And in keeping with its tradition of excellence, when it wanted a good professor, it found Dr. Eric Routley, a native of England, an ordained pastor in the United Reformed Church of England, which was a merger of the Congregational Church of England and the Presbyterian Church of England. Dr. Routley is a distinguished scholar himself, no serious student of church music and hymnology would pursue his studies without having given attention to what Dr. Routley has said and written in his numerous works. Dr. Routley is the professor of church music and the director of the chapel of Westminster Choir College. My first acquaintance with him came through his writings. Then I heard him speak at a church music conference at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And about 2.5 years ago, I took a course with him at Westminster Choir College. That course was a one-week course with 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the afternoon. Those of you at Concordia Seminary who have had to sit through 2.5-hour marathon sessions in the afternoon know that it sometimes is a little difficult to do that. I listened to Dr. Routley for 6 hours per day, and I found that he was as interesting in the sixth hour as he was in the first hour. He's not going to be given 6 hours here today. But in the time that you listen to him, I'm sure that you will agree he has both the capacity and the knowledge to hold the attention of an audience for that length of time. When you hear Dr. Routley, you will not hear my Wisconsin accent, nor will you hear Dr. Harm's Brooklynese. You will hear the King's English, pure and simple. Dr. Routley.
Well, that was a most kind introduction. And yes, indeed, as you can hear, I haven't yet mastered the language of Canaan. I'm working on it, but I'm rather old to change things like that. In Princeton, in fact, there are 5 institutions of higher learning, each dottier than the next one. The one that it was very wise not to mention was Princeton Theological Seminary. Which I don't doubt you know well as the fountainhead of all heresy. At least, that's what I call it. Speaking as an English Calvinist. Well, I'm delighted to be among you. I now realize that you are the circular people, whereas the other lot of Lutherans are the squares. In fact, I have just had placed in my hand this attractive and formidable blue book, which I don't doubt you'll be hearing all about.
within a matter of hours.
And I must certainly congratulate the Missouri Synod on getting this book onto the street, because I know what it is to edit a hymn book. I'm doing one at the moment. Oh, not for people that you would want to have anything to do with. For the Reformed Church in America, who are a small and, I may say, theologically not inconsiderable body, who nonetheless are rebelling against using the hymnal that the Presbyterians have been using and that they have been sharing for many years and decided to have one of their own. Well, you won't like it, and I won't bother you with the description of it, but at least I know, at least I anticipate, what a day of triumph it is when a hymnal that you have been working on for a long time is actually bound and printed and available. So I hope you'll have fun with the one you've got. And of course, it is a very suitable coincidence that this should have happened from my point of view, because I am offering you the subject of hymns. Take them seriously or leave them. Now, I used to work in a place called Newcastle. And the only thing that anybody in the United States knows about Newcastle in England is that it's a place you don't take coals to. As a matter of fact, all the coal mines in Newcastle were worked out a long time ago, and we need it as much as anybody else does. But the expression taking coals to Newcastle means giving somebody an unnecessary gift, and even an embarrassing one. And I feel that coming and speaking to Lutherans, especially of your kind, about hymnody is a very good example of taking coals precisely there. Because if anybody does take these things seriously, surely it must be you. You stand in a tradition which invented vernacular hymnody. Some of us feel that you did some very strange things with it, but but you did indeed invent it, in the person of the great Martin himself. And it has always been quite clearly the very existence of a blue as against a green. Green indicates that it's always been the conviction of the Missouri Synod that hymns are of very, very great importance to the people in worship, and that it is most necessary that they should sing the right ones. In the year 1892, which was a little before I was born, though there must be some people in this room who were around then, in the year 1892, a man who managed not to go insane published a dictionary of hymnology, John Julian. And he claimed that there were 400,000 hymns in existence. Well, I don't know how many there are now, but I should think it's nearer a million than half a million. So, of course, any Christian group that uses hymns at all, and now, except for the English Quakers, they all do, even the Catholics do, and a fine mess they're making of it. Any Christian group that uses hymns has got to choose the 500 or so, or in England, the 700 or 800 or so, which it will suggest that its particular generation uses. Now, of course, hymns have a very special place. Ever since Luther got them out of the monasteries and into the parishes, have a very special place in Christian worship. It is thus describable. There are certain things in Christian worship that do not alter. The creeds, for example, despite everything that people in Boston have tried to do with them, are still there. We have the Athanasian Creed. I don't know if you have that. We have the Nicene Creed, and we have the Apostles' Creed. The Apostles' Creed's got nothing to do with the Apostles, nor has the Athanasian Creed anything to do with Athanasius. And the Nicene Creed is not the text of the creed that was published in Nicaea. But still, we give them those amiable names. And although the translation may be altered from time to time, there they are. And there is also, despite the activities of people in the northeastern United States, the Bible. Now, I don't doubt that there are still people, and there will always be people, who say, ah, yes, of course, the Bible's awfully good, but why don't we add to it the works of, let us say, Mark Twain? Being in the state of Missouri, we'd better say Mark Twain. But there the Bible obstinately stays. And on those two things our worship is founded. And any worship that strays far from the doctrines of the creed and the teaching of Scripture is very soon going to become something else. Something else, very agreeable, no doubt, but not worship. However, hymns change. Hymns change from, hymn books change from generation to generation, and hymns, of course, express the interpretation of, and above all, the response of the people to, the doctrines of the creeds and the teaching of Scripture as is appropriate to the various generations. Now, hymnals last one generation, and they've been like that ever since the first large and properly arranged hymnal appeared, and that was only in 1780, so far as the English language is concerned, John Wesley's hymnal. And ever since then, each generation has tended to say, those hymns can go on sabbatical, or can be superannuated for good, these hymns we want to keep, and these other hymns we want to add. So, hymn books move at a rhythm of anything from 20 to 40 years. Here is 1982. Well, this replaces one that was made in 1941. And that's a long time. The Episcopals produced a hymn book in 1943, and they are planning to produce another one in 1985. Presbyterians are much more brisk or much more impatient. They had one in 1933, another one in 1955, another one that was a complete bomb in 1972. But that is the thing about hymns, that they express each generation's interpretation of and response to the unchanging teaching of the Church. And even the Missouri Synod is prepared from time to time to revise its interpretations and its response. So that makes them human. Well, what we believe, if we believe anything about hymns, is that they are precision instruments. That's the line that I want to follow. That is the one of the sort of basic things that I want to get said. That the hymns in a hymnal are precision instruments, and the hymnal is a kit of precision tools. Ideally, each of those has the job it does best in interpreting and providing the people's response to the teaching of the Church. Each hymnal is a kit of, as far as possible, tools, each of which has a job to do. Well, in practice, I don't know if you are sinners, but most people are. And the tendency is, of course, for the system to break down here and there, and one to discover some pages in a hymnal containing material that seems to be of no use for any known purpose, but there may be some eccentric somewhere who finds a use for it. Now, I, being of a decaying generation, am no good at doing things about the house. If something breaks down, a shelf comes off the wall and I've got to put it on, the wall will come down. But at least I know this, that you do not use a screwdriver to do a job that a chisel ought to be doing, or a scratch-all. And one of the ways in which you can make a good book into a bad one, or make a good hymn into a bad one, is by misusing it. By making it do a screwdriver's job when in fact it is a chisel, or the other way round. Now, I have noticed, though you must realize that I have had very little contact with your distinguished section of the church, but I have noticed that the idea of using hymns as precision tools is one that has faded very largely in this country. Certainly amongst the people I know best, it has undoubtedly faded, with the consequence that I suppose the churches I most often visit in this country are Presbyterian, and about half the Sundays in the year I'm visiting Presbyterian churches. They don't usually ask me a second time, so I get plenty of chance to see the variety of them. But I really do notice that the repertory in those churches, out of a hymn book of 552 hymns, is about 30 or 40, not counting Christmas carols. Everybody knows all the Christmas carols, but all the rest, bless my soul, you can count on. Joyful, joyful, we adore thee. God save the mark. You can count on one of the first 15 hymns in the book being the first hymn. You can count on a small selection of the 300s, the very devotional hymns, being the second one. And you can count on one of the first 15 in the book being the last one. People have excluded hymn singing from their services altogether. In some places, I've been in churches. Not Lutheran, I need hardly say. I wouldn't be admitted to one. But I've been in churches where there are two hymns, during both of which the choir is walking about in the church. Most extraordinary behavior. I'm there in the congregation, perhaps. At the end of the service, as soon as I start to sing, the choir walks out. I think it's a bit pointed. And they expect me to start singing at the beginning of the service before they're in the room. And there aren't any other hymns in the service in some, well, churches of these heretical denominations. People have lost what they used to have. And what I am sure you do have. And I'm really not telling you what you ought to do, but telling you how the other half lives, and you may as well know. They are losing the idea of hymns being anything more but just a chance for the congregation to have a go. Now, this is... Well, I don't think... I don't think all these people are going to hell, you understand. They're losing an opportunity. Because what a hymn really is in a service, and I think I'm doing my best to be as general as possible, but I really think you'd agree with this, and I really think that this is what Luther wanted them to be. What a hymn is the chance for the unmusical and untheological people in the congregation, who are not paid to be musical, not paid to be theological, they're paid to be computer operators or something, but it's a chance for them to say yes, wow, amen, to what has just happened. And so, of course, in those parts of the church where hymn singing has developed in the most lively way, the hymns have been the congregation's part in the liturgy. Now, you will understand yourselves better if I tell you, you probably know it, but it won't be within your direct experience, what was the background of that hymnody which is not Lutheran, but Calvinist? That hymnody which, on the whole, has its richest expression in the English language, not in the German or Scandinavian languages. You see, it was all very well for Luther, who produced his 37 hymns, and there they are in volume 53 of the Concordia Luther, marvellous it is to have them all together there, so well edited. Luther built his hymns right into the liturgy of the church, and so far as he was concerned, 37 hymns would do. Well, now that's about the repertory of a modern Presbyterian, but most of our hymn books have more than 37 in them. Luther's hymns are found to be very difficult to sing by anybody who's not a Lutheran. You know them all by heart. But then, you probably use them very frequently. And Luther assumed that they would be used very frequently, that some would be sung at every Mass. And so people soon got to know long chorales, complicated tunes, which, if you got a repertoire of 500 hymns, and my congregation in Newcastle sang 534 different hymns during my 7 years of ministry, I counted them, they don't have time to learn great long things like the Luther Creed. But hymn singing wouldn't be what it is if it hadn't been for a very, very disorderly crowd of people called the English Congregationalists, of whom I am one. You may have heard the name of Isaac Watts, conceivably. Isaac Watts was one of these. He wrote, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross." And would even you want to be without that? He wrote, "Our God, Our Help in Ages Past," and though the boneheaded editors of the Green Book have altered the harmonies of the tune for no discernible reason except to offer one more insult to the English, I think I could still say that you wouldn't want to be without that. Now, the background from which Watts came was a Christian group that had no liturgy at all, that thought it was popish and wicked and hell-deserving and every kind of adjective that they could summon to have a book that you read the service out of. So nobody knew what was coming. They went to church, and everything depended on the minister, who would preach twice in a service. He would read the scriptures and then expound them for 20 minutes. And then, after a brief interval for, well, not so brief as all that for prayer, would then go on to the sermon, which would last an hour. They had a lot of time in those days, nothing else much to do. But that's what the service was. And if it hadn't been for the hymns, there would have been nothing familiar. There would have been no way in which anybody could have brought something out of his own home into church and said, "This is mine as well as yours." But that's what the hymns of that tradition meant. Now, you may say it's a terrible thing that anybody should have fallen into such gruesome habits as those. One is bound to say that the Calvinist churches, the Reformed Church, the Lutheran, the Congregational Church, the Presbyterian Church, and so forth, now believe themselves to have some sense of liturgy. Whether rightly or not, I will leave aside for the moment. But that is what produced the incredible richness of Watts's 750 and Wesley's 6,000 and James Montgomery's 300. And people wrote. And of course, the best ones more or less came to the top, and the others sang without trace. And so all our hymnals, including yours, have hymns of that tradition as well. On which, of course, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross" is one. And "Hark the Herald Angels Sing" is another, by Charles Wesley. And "Love Divine, All Loves Excelling." I wonder if these people thought that was too erotic. No, they got it. Now, for good or ill, you people, who are pure and unspotted from the world in so many ways, have inherited a lot of hymnody from that bunch. And you'll have to make the most of it. But you will realize that while Luther's hymnody could count on a context, you see, a predictable liturgy, a liturgy full of beauty and drama, for Luther was every inch an artist. That's what differentiates him from Calvin. While Luther could count on that, the people who wrote these hymns really had to pack in the doctrine and the scripture, because there was no predictable context at all. But the consequence of that is that you find a hymn like "Love Divine, All Loves Excelling," and although many people think of it, as they think of all hymns, as a pleasant tune with some words that happen to fit it, the point about "Love Divine, All Loves Excelling" is that it is packed with the Bible. It assumes doctrine, for Charles Wesley was indeed a card-carrying Anglican minister, and never anything else. And so he respected the doctrines that will be found in the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. But above all, of course, he respected Scripture. And so you have expressions like suddenly return, and never, never more thy temples leave. Malachi. And it makes it a fine hymn for the Advent season. Or you have expressions like changed from glory into glory, which means that the hymn will have a new resonance if it is sung in a service in which 2 Corinthians 3 is part of the lectionary. You see, if hymns are married to the Scriptures that they should never have been divorced from, then they are going to be what Luther and Isaac Watts equally wanted them to be. They are at their best when they are known to the people who sing them. When those people, as I said, and I'll say it again because I want to emphasize it, really regard the hymns as part of their property and not only the church's. That's when hymns are at their best. That leads me to say something rather nasty, but I am obliged to say it. In the sort of church that I come from, in a foreign country, in a foreign kind of church, I don't know if this is true of your kind of people, but at least we can compare notes about it. People of a couple of generations back, that is to say, people who are a generation older than I am, found it quite normal to own their own hymnal, to bring it to church with them and sing from it, to take it back home again and sing from it there, and above all, to read from it. Hymnals in England were, until recently, always published in an edition that didn't have any music, so that the hymnal looked like a book of poetry, and you could read it easily. The comprehension of words, as any person who is an authority on these matters, depends not on reading one syllable after another, but on reading whole chunks, whole phrases of words. People have proved that. They've watched extraordinary things people do with their time. They watched other people reading, you see, and watched how their eyes jump from here to there along the line, you see. You don't read im, more, tell, in, vi, zi, bull, god, own, li, wise, not after you're 4 years old. You read the whole thing. Well, when people were like that, people in that kind of church didn't have a worship book, didn't have a prayer book, didn't have a breviary, never anything like that. And the hymn book was all that. And they would have their hymn book and their Bible together on the table, and if they were rushed off to hospital, they would take the hymnal and the Bible with them and read both. Now, of course, that meant that hymns meant an awful lot to these people, and meant something very different to them from what they mean when people find the hymn book in the church. The hymn book then becomes just one more thing the church does to them. And the essence of worship, I don't know, I hope this isn't heretical, but you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the essence of worship is conversation. Word and answer. As more than one eminent German theologian has pointed out, Wort und Antwort. The word of God and the response. Not merely the response of saying, if you say so, I'll buy it, but, yes, I was going to say that myself. Now, when a preacher gets that out of people, that preacher, of course, has got home. If a preacher simply gets the reaction, well, I see, he hasn't got anywhere. He might as well, he's wasting his time, he might as well not have started. But when a preacher has the person in the congregation say, yes, that's just what I was going to say, though they weren't, of course, And the idea wouldn't have come if the preacher hadn't put it into their minds. But if they say it's me, then something has begun to happen. Something has got started up. And hymns are designed for to do that for people. So that even if they are stupidly chosen by the pastor or the liturgist or whoever's busy choosing them, people come into church singing praise to the Lord the Almighty, I suppose that's an uncontroversial one, and saying, this is mine. I don't care about Catherine Winkworth, who's that? And who's this fellow Neander, the Stralsund Gesangbuch 1665? Don't care tuppence about that, it belongs to me, they say. And, of course, if the verse, for instance, is sung where it says, hast thou not seen, all thy heart's wishes have been granted in what he ordained. Suppose that is sung at a baptism. What do you suppose it's going to mean to the mother and the father? They're going to say, wow, sure they have. So, you see, the pastoral sense in choosing hymns and in using them does involve precision and knowledge. There's got to be somebody in every church who knows the hymn book backwards. Maybe there'll be some Philistine minister who doesn't want to be bothered with that. If so, then it'd better be somebody else who does it. It's better to have the hymns intelligently chosen by a lay person than unintelligently chosen by the minister just because he's the minister. Sometimes I sort of say, well, there needs to be a resident hymnologist in every church. And it is perfectly possible for somebody who really knows the book, knowing the subject, knowing the lectionary, knowing the emphasis of the day, to find three or four hymns that are going to be exactly right, where the minister might be too busy or too uninterested to do so, but you really want to aim at that. Now let me turn to the other point that I want to make, which is the necessarily critical approach that we must have. Now, there are always occasions when we say, sorry, that isn't a good one. Wow, this is. You'll be very familiar with that cast of thinking. You will say, oh, that's bad hymn, this is a good one. You will say, no, up there in River Forest, they will say, if it's an English tune, it's no good. The German one's bound to be fine. But you have your standards of criticism. You know, that which is known as hymnology is a study that is not much more than 100 years old. People in older days didn't really approach hymns with a critical mind. Perhaps it was a nicer world in those ways. They approached them with a grateful one. But it has been necessary because of certain corruptions that have found their way in for people occasionally to say this will not quite do. One of the first people to say that was Ralph Vaughan Williams. Well, he was an English musician, but both his names were Welsh. So, perhaps he's all right. Ralph Vaughan Williams, who wrote For All the Saints and Come Down, O Love Divine. Good. He wrote those, he's a magnificent musician, and he said something in the preface to his hymnal, which was called the English hymnal, perhaps bolder than anything that even Lutherans have ever said, though I've not yet had time to read the preface to this one. Vaughan Williams said, at the age of 32, when he was an unknown musician, good taste in these matters is a moral concern. That's what he said. Now, it is. He was right. Some people think he was tactless, and some people think that in his enthusiasm for good standards, he was sometimes wrong. But there is a need to distinguish. Because, and this I was saying to the senior members of the college yesterday, and I repeat it to you, music has a very, very profound effect on people, which is not necessarily good. Let me offer you this experiment, which I rather fancy won't come off. But I'm going to try it. What is this tune? Does anybody recognize that tune who is under 50?
First blast of
time. Well, of course, you're quite right. And it's the very first time I've had a correct answer to that question. The tune is the Horst Wessel song, which was a one of the theme songs of the Nazi youth movement in Germany in 1930s. But, of course, people very often say, isn't that how great thou art? Those two melodies, in the same meter, in the same key, How Great Thou Art is to me, but possibly, because of that accidental association, one of the hymns that, on balance, probably does more harm than good, because it is one of the hymns that people always sing in a half-conscious, glassy-eyed way, without really attending to what the hymn says. And I think that the difficulty has always come, and I want to give you a few examples to illustrate this, and then I shall more or less have finished what I want to say. It's one of the many examples of how when a hymn or a tune loses that elusive virtue of chastity, it corrupts at once. Now, any style can do this. The Luther style, of course, was very much a closed shop. And yet, even there, even during Luther's lifetime, there were people who said the Luther tunes are too difficult, people aren't singing them, we'd better have something simpler. And the great danger was that by simpler, they meant more superficially attractive, but in the end less edifying. I will repeat the example I gave yesterday to the others, because it will be familiar to you. In the green edition of your book, there are two tunes that were associated with the hymn Nun freut euch. One was written in 1524, the other in 1535. And the 1524 tune is this one. That is how it originally went. A fine tune, magnificent tune, imaginative tune, a musician's tune, or a Lutheran's tune. That is to say, when you have really got into your bones and sung it very frequently, it becomes really exciting and edifying, and it keeps on delivering a great deal of inspiration because of its rather startling musical language. Those two rising forths, one after the other, are just the kind of thing that makes a musician say, wow, but makes, let us say, a Presbyterian layman say, what's going on? Because folk music doesn't use consecutive rising fourths. You'll never find a folk song that does that. You've got to learn it. You've got to say, come on in here, learn what we do, and then all's well. Well, in 1535, a much simpler tune for the same words appeared in Klug's book, which goes like this. ¶¶ always been able to understand the triad, and they've always found it rather difficult, if they're not musical, to understand anything else. But what a boring tune the second one is. Particularly in the old German version that you keep. At 321 in the Green Book. What it is in this book, I don't know, but... the art can, of course, run into difficulties when the artist is moving just too fast for ordinary people. But you will find in the early days of hymnody that there are far fewer corruptions than there are when hymnody becomes more permissive and when the currency is inflated. The English psalm tune, for example, is nearly always a model, if you don't mind my saying so, of how to get a great deal into a small space. English psalm tunes in the common meter can be sung over and over again, can be even sung in the irresponsible way in which some people sing them, and still not lose all their character. Things like this. Your Green Book did with that tune, isn't it? You must have noticed all Luther tunes have got to be in their original rhythm. Pa-pom, pom, 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 ta-ta, ta-ta, pom, pom. Lovely syncopation, but not the English psalm tunes, oh no. Those long notes are absolutely essential in that splendid tune, Dundee. But, you see, it's only got one thing to say, which is that rising to the top note, wah-da-dee, and it has one harmonic thing to say, once it got harmonized, which it wasn't at first, and those two single points, not saying any more, not making a lot more fuss, the rest of it being completely traditional and dogmatic, those two points of interpretation of dogma make it a great tune. So the result is this, isn't it? You can mess it about, you can choose it irresponsibly, you can play it as though it was a gavotte, and it'll still work. Well, again, the repertory was small, they were only singing metrical psalms, the same with the Calvin Genevan psalms, which I'd love to go on about for an hour, but won't. But when we got to pietism and evangelicalism, then things began to become a bit permissive. Now, all the German tunes, except for a what you would call corrupt version of A Mighty Fortress, all the German tunes that non-Lutherans know are pietist. They are 17th century tunes, Our Holy Jesus, and Praise to the Lord the Almighty, and Unser Herrscher, lots of marvellous tunes that come from the friendly period, rather than the dogmatic period of German hymnody. And we love them. Now thank we all our God. All my heart this night rejoices. Lots and lots of them. But the thing that is often hid from us is that these were almost all composed to be either solos or house music, family music. Congregational hymnody was not really a part of the pietist tradition at all, because congregational action wasn't. It was a very individualist form of religion. And of course, all the texts are in the first person singular practically always. Extravagance of some of the pietist melodies, the operatic extravagance of them, which don't find their way into the hymnals at all, indicates that a certain sensational quality had entered into this, and people were allowing the hymn to become a little less disciplined than it had been. Well, the same was true of the Methodists. And in English-speaking hymnody, of course, the Methodists did what the Pietists did in Germany. Produced some marvelous texts. You have your Gerhardt, we have our Charles Wesley. And produced some wonderful tunes with red blood in them and warm hearts in them, which we all love. The typical evangelical tune is that tune which I presume you sing on Easter Day. Jesus Christ is risen today. Did you know that that was taken by the evangelicals under the influence of the Wesleys and recast from the original? I don't know whether you've got both in your books. The original went like this. Evangelical tunes have a mixture of restraint and at the same time welcoming power. Well, it was awfully easy for people to say, oh, anybody can do that. So that English evangelicalism, in the end, produced a raft of tunes in which there's any amount of rhetoric and no reason at all. Now, you have never heard sermons like that, but believe me, I have. I spent a whole semester in a Presbyterian college, Princeton Seminary, playing the organ for services and listening to 79 sermons, and upon my soul, I knew what it was. Oh, I've probably done it myself. To produce sermons exactly like evangelical tunes at their worst. Because, of course, the rhetoric of a tune is the tune, and the reason of a tune is the bass. And so you get marvelous noises like this. So to make up for that, the preacher shouts. The preacher produces sentence after sentence in which the first five words of the sentence are the same. You know, turn him on at 8 o'clock any Sunday morning in a motel and you hear him doing it. So, once people say, isn't it nice to do this? They're liable to say it doesn't really matter whether it's the right thing to do or not. And so we get, you see, via all sorts of strange temperaments, including the ugly 20th century tune, the nasty 20th century tune, and nobody could possibly sing, though it's very cleverly written. To, in the end, the nadir of permissive music, which afflicted England in the 1950s, and which you wouldn't know much about here, but there are people not 100 miles from this spot who are promoting it. I mean, of course, the popular music, the music often associated with guitars, the music that people think, oh, isn't this fun? Like committing adultery for the first time. And the church doesn't say they mustn't, because the church never says no to anything. Do you know the following tune to Now Thank We All Our God, which was seriously sung all over England in 1958?
It's not better than it.
There is one American hymn book that carries that. The hymn book of a highly permissive denomination known as the Disciples of Christ and the American Baptists. Now, if it isn't that kind of thing, which perhaps is so obvious as to be not particularly dangerous, it can be the kind of hymnody that induces people into an irrational, half-asleep attitude, not only to worship, but also the Christian faith in general. So that you can usually recognize the signs. Now, you don't have to be all that musical to do it. A great tune has always been as like a really good folk song as possible. When the folk are at their best. Now, you can say the folk song of today is acid rock. So I have to say when the folk are at their best and when the demons have not got at them. But there are many beautiful hymn tunes that are actually taken from old folk songs. And I'm afraid I've got to quote England again. I don't know if you know this one, but where it's used, everybody loves it. It was originally called The Ploughboy's Dream. Are you permitted enough to sing? Which was originally called With My Love on the Road. Or... Now, the great tune is like that, and the fine folk song always has a commanding start, a consistent movement, and a climax. There's always something it's moving towards, and usually near the end, and that it abruptly comes away from. It takes you on a journey where you see a fine view from the top, and then brings you home quick. All the great tunes are like that. Dundee was like that, or Stone Bridge is so. One long butterfly. In the same way, words need to have a point that only they make. Now, I have had time to discover that there is one incomparable hymn in the green book that the blue book's left out. It's by my beloved Isaac Watts, and is carefully set by the editors of the green book to an awful tune. Nature with open volume. What about this for a description of one's response to the cross? Here his whole name appears complete. Nor wit can guess, nor reason prove which of the letters best is writ, the power, the wisdom, or the love. Can you possibly manage without that? I mean, as soon as you see that, you sort of think, well, it's Cawthorne, 1 Corinthians 1, but I've never seen it that way before, and yet it's always been that way. Or that other superb hymn that speaks of the easy speeches that comfort cruel men, that angry national hymn by Chesterton, O God of Earth and Altar. Or the eloquence of your own Martin Fransman. Or the evangelical warmth, yet the bite of a thing like Christ whose glory fills the skies. You see, if you can recover the art of enjoying reading and enjoying hearing, and if you can get hold of a hymn book that you can read and read it before you sing it, of course these hymn books you can't, then I think hymnody is going to come alive. And I think that the people who don't care tuppence about its quality will gradually find that people are walking away from them, and the people who are so toffee-nosed that they think they've got nothing to learn because they know it all will suddenly discover that a poet and a musician has surprised them into a new kind of joy. Well, that's what I wanted to say. I don't know if anybody wants to ask anything.
Thank you, Dr. Routley. I'm sure you proved this morning what I said in the introduction. We could go on for another 5 hours and enjoy this. But Dr. Routley has agreed to answer questions, and if you have a few to ask, he will respond in much the same way that he has in his presentation. He will have a strong opinion, and he will also substantiate the opinion. So speak the questions loudly, please. I'll try to repeat them so that those at that end of the room are heard here, and Dr. Routley will come to the microphone to answer. Charles, I believe you were first there.
That's one, Dr. Routley. I've been in congregations that sing and congregations that don't. And how does one build a congregation that sings and goes right before him?
Did you all understand the question? Fine.
Well, that is admirably asked, because it turns out to be most important if you're going to have this new hymn book. In the first place, you will always get better singing if the things you choose are chosen with relevance to their context. In general, in a general way, lackadaisical singing comes of people thinking it doesn't matter because the people at the other end of the church appear to think it doesn't matter too. But there are certain things you can do, especially if you're at the beginning of a time with a new hymnal. I think the greatest thing, the best opportunity, is to organize a potluck supper. I hope that expression is understood in Missouri. I can tell you nobody does it better than the people in Pennsylvania, who of course also are German people. A potluck supper on Wednesday, or whenever choir practice isn't, aren't any other things that matter very much in the church. Organize this and get people enjoying one another and meeting on church premises, but not for worship. And then remaining in the fellowship hall with your piano, run a hymn singing for an hour. And start by singing something that everybody knows. And say, good heavens, you call that singing? You know, even if they sang it well, you insult them a bit, people love it. Then you have another one, and then you say, now, I don't know if there's anything anybody would like to sing. How great thou art. Yes, indeed, we'll have one verse of that. And then you say, now you've had your turn, I'm going to have mine, and here comes. And you find that people in a good-humored and good-tempered mood, and we'll learn three new hymns quite quickly. Another thing to do in church, if a hymn is obviously going to make its point but people don't know it, is, quite honestly, to let the choir sing some of it. If it's a short hymn, let the choir sing the whole and the congregation respond by singing the whole. But if there are five stanzas, you can let the choir sing the first two or three and say to the congregation, come on in now. Don't make it the first or the last hymn in the service. But people quite quickly say, oh, I can do that. And we'll go along. There are other things that you could do if your hymn books were properly printed, like insisting on the text but not worrying whether the tune set to it in the book is the tune that you're going to sing in the church. You probably are not used to the idea, but it's an extremely valuable one, of changing the tune. We constantly do it in England. And it's very easy because we always print the text separately, even in the music edition. So that the people have got a tune they know that they sing by ear and can attend to the words. There is indeed one hymn which is very well known and which has a blameless tune which nonetheless is tremendously illuminated. If it is sung to another well-known tune, and that's the church's one foundation. Now, I believe I can sell this to Germans. In fact, I once did, when I had a congregation of Germans who were trying to sing English hymns and they couldn't do it. And we came to the church's one foundation, and instead of having that rather broken back tune that goes to it, we sang it this. That's beside the point. But any good-humoured way of introducing new hymns to congregations that doesn't interrupt worship and is preferably mostly applied at another time altogether, I think is the best way to introduce people to new hymns.
I think you received a straight answer, didn't you, Charles? Kent, you had your hand up.
Well, it's a thing we call in England a bradawl. But I was taught to call it a scratchawl in New Jersey. I went into a store and asked for a bradawl. They didn't know what I was talking about. It's a thing you make holes with.
Next question, Ken.
The biggest harmless joke made in hymnody, I think, for a long time. He means earth and all stars, which is a very Lutheran production. Lutheran, words Lutheran tune, earth and all stars, and it's all, everything is loud. Let's have a look at it. It's most amusing. We sang it on our campus. An Anglican was preaching and asked for it, and we had to get the copyright and copy it out and all that jazz. But made the campus laugh like drains. 558. 558. Oh, yes, this is where we get a very dubious section here. Earth and all stars, loud rushing planets, sing to the Lord a new song. Nice tune, lovely tune. Loud shouting army. Loud blowing snowstorm. Loud clashing cymbals. Loud pounding hammers. Loud rustling dry leaves. Loud humming cellos, zang. Loud building workers, loud boiling test tubes, loud cheering people, loud sounding wisdom, loud praying members. They must be charismatics. I think it's good, clean fun, but you sang it three times, you get dead tired of it because it is so affected, you see, it's so contrived. He wants everything to be loud. Well, personally, at my advanced age, I don't. But the tune's nice. The tune is really pickable. I'd like another take for it. But I don't find the words all that clever. And I've shown it to one or two scientists who say, good heavens.
Are there any other questions or comments? Yes, Tim?
It seems to me that one of the problems that wasn't mentioned come along is the restriction that your organist might be able to put on your ability to sing some of the hymns.
Well,
that as much of good intentions as the pastor might be, it might be beyond the capability of the organist to assist the people in singing hymns as well.
Do you hear the comment back there?
How organists can kill hymns stone dead is the subject, yes? Well, I'll tell you, I've had a lot of experience in preaching in the country churches of the loneliest county in England, which is Northumberland, where sometimes they don't have an organist, and whoever's preaching has got to play the pump organ as well. It's a splendid discipline to have an organist who really isn't very good, because then you've got to stick to the psalm tunes. You've got to stick to the absolutely simplest tunes. And if the organist can only give a note, at least people can sing them. The Wild Shepherd's Watch tunes, the Dundee tunes, that kind of thing. But of course, it is better if an organist has a bit of technique. But I don't care if the organist is on the top line of the Murtagh agency for giving recitals. Sometimes they can kill him stone dead. They have plenty of technique, but no love of people. No interest in the people sitting down there. No imagination of what it's like to be down there without much musical technique trying to sing a hymn. And they play it. The wildest speeds, too fast or too slow. They get a long meter tune, all irregular notes, and they give nobody time to breathe. The great problem is with the good organist, not with the bad one. Really. But do encourage whatever organist you have, and it may be somebody who's doing it to oblige and isn't paid. So you don't feel that you can do much about it. But do suggest to them that, above all, the hymns should be practiced. It doesn't matter if there's no incoming music and no outgoing music. And if, when you take up the collection, all you can hear is the rustling of the leaves and the tramping of the feet, the perfectly godly sounds. If an organist gave all the limited time they got to getting the hymns right, and even playing the right notes, they would be doing the best job they could. So I really wouldn't hope for that. But as I say, I've suffered more from good organists than from bad ones.
Other questions or comments? Dr. Grothy?
Way in the back there.
Oh, I see. Over here, please.
Yes, sir. With a younger generation that is, like you say, weaned on rock and roll music, and just it being a victory congregation, it seems like they have a very difficult time appreciating anything besides either Bruce Springsteen or Led Zeppelin. What do we do to make the music, especially the hymn of music, which is sacred to us, what do we do to make that appealing to them? How do we go about educating?
Well, I really think it is a case, it's a parallel case to the preacher who is preaching to a generation trained in intellectual sloppiness. How do you get people to appreciate it? The answer is never be too impatient. But don't say, let's invite some of those wolves into the fold. A pastor is supposed to keep the wolves out. And if, of course, if you believe in rock, not to say roll, then if you believe that it is in conformity with the gospel, then you are entitled, of course, to use it and encourage it and so forth. I do not, myself, I'm afraid. I have never regarded it as anything but a demonic perversion, and therefore the only thing to do has been to say to such people as have suffered under me, this doesn't happen in here. Same as adultery doesn't happen in here. Same as all sorts of things that happen outside don't happen in here. Of course they don't. So, then, do you all constantly go on saying, it's bad, it's naughty, don't do it? No, of course you don't. The only way, I think, to teach people anything to do with the gospel, specifically to do with the gospel, is example. As soon as people think you're educating them, they'll think you're patronizing them. And in most ways, I've always found that my congregation was better educated than I was, quite a lot of the time. All sorts of things in which they were much better at their jobs than I was at mine. So it never occurred to me to say, now I'm going to tell you what to do. I could only, myself, set an example and simply resist any attempt specifically to introduce into the church that kind of, as I think, demonic behavior. So I think I'll tell again the story I told yesterday afternoon. There was a time at Newcastle, again, when during the coffee hour after church, where the young people were served mostly with fruit juice and the older people with coffee, which showed you that the young people had more sense because the coffee was evil, a little girl comes up to me and says, can we have the new tune to O Jesus I Have Promised? And this is the tune she meant. I mean, it was so unkind, but I did say to her, I'll tell you why. It's the first time she heard a minister ever say no to anything. I'd just been checking whether the drink that you've got in your hand contains poison. Cyclamates were the talking point in Newsweek or whatever it was, in about 1960, whatever it was, 970. And we all thought and knew it was naughty to drink cyclamates, and we tried not to order soft drinks that had them in. And I said, I've been to see whether that stuff you're drinking is poison. This music's poison. Well, there was a specific request. I got very few. Most people, I suppose, knew what sort of answer they'd get. But I really don't think it is wise specifically to introduce styles that have to do with so much secular grief into the church. And if people want them and you don't want them, you must say it's not going to happen and this is why. I don't think our modern young are as impenetrable as our modern middle-aged and elderly. The young speak their minds, but rather often it isn't their minds they're speaking. It's the mind of some commercial firm that is making a lot of money out of these musical and cultural drugs. So if you can make simple music, I don't mean complicated music, I don't want them all singing the Fauré Requiem at once. I mean the Forest Green, you see, I mean Capel, I mean these real folk songs. If you can make that part of a friendly and commanding and authoritative and delightful church climate, they'll buy it. Just as when you preach, you are not going to use words in the slovenly and sloppy way in which they're used on commercials. You are not going to, I heard a beautiful coinage only 2 days ago on the radio, prosecutorial wise. You're not going to murder words like that. You're going to use words of one syllable. You're going to model your preaching on the poem, Come My Way, My Truth, My Life, which has one word that isn't one syllable in it. You will not change that style for anybody. If people come and say it's above their heads, or if people come and say they wish you were more flowery or more eloquent, you'll say, I'm so sorry, I'm not. Your aim will nonetheless be to make this, what you believe to be the style of simplicity and austerity that is in conformity with the gospel and that is needed by this present permissive generation, you will make that as friendly and delightful as you can make it. As I said yesterday, it's a pastor's business, we often think, to make people's pleasures righteous, but you must make their righteousness pleasant as well. Then I think, don't be frightened by these demons. Screw tape is very clever, as we all know, but he doesn't know it all.
Mrs. Fremder?
Is it possible that in the church they have come to this, that they have special music for the children, special music for the teenagers, and then when they get to the adults, they expect them to accept the adult music, and they haven't been taught this?
Yes.
And in times past, they used to teach them the hymns, and from little on up, they were singing the good, fine, phenomenal church music.
Did you hear the comment back there?
Well, of course, if that is true, it's a regression. It's a perversion. It's the demons at work. I've never been, all through my, 38 years of ministerial life, I have never been particularly interested in young people. I'm only interested in people. And when I was young, which I can remember very well because I have a rather good memory, I didn't want to be young. I wanted to be grown up. I was longing for the next thing to happen. I didn't want to stick there at the age of 8, and if I had done, I would have been a monster. Now, we treat people as though they were. And the children, perhaps in some churches, Presbyterian, I expect, sing about butterflies and daisies. And the young people sing that kind of rock and roll type. And then they come into church, and the whole thing's a foreign language. Of course, every department in the church should use the same hymnal. I was taught, Trenian, praise to the holiest in the height, and praise my soul, the King of Heaven. I knew very few children's hymns, and I laughed at them when I was young. Children's hymns in worship, of a very elementary and embarrassing kind, the worst thing they do is, if they are aimed at the 8-year-old, they embarrass the 11-year-old like anything, more than they embarrass us. No, hymn books should be part of the catechism. Of course, you will be careful not to put them off. There are some hymns that are of adult taste, like Worcester Sauce. And Oh God, I Hope in Ages Past is one of them, I remember. Of course, I revere it now, but I remember the first time I heard it, thinking how terrible it was. And I could, if I had another half an hour, I could tell you exactly why that tune does put young people off. There's a technical reason for it. But upon my soul, the great hymns of the church, even if they don't understand them, and perhaps especially if they don't understand them, are the ones they should learn. Because how marvelous, like the Bible, to have read the great stories of the patriarchs, and then to be reading them all your life, and suddenly realizing at the age of 48 that there is no better treatise on criminology than the story of Joseph. You know, you don't think that when you're 8, you think exciting story. When you're 8, you think praise to the holiest. I don't think that's a hymn you probably use, but it's one of my favorites. It's a nice tune. And the double agony in man for man to undergo. You sort of think, I remember hearing Come, O Thou Traveler, another of the hymns that I always value, when I was 13. And thinking, I don't know what this is about, but by gad, it's marvelous. Then I hunted around for Genesis 32 and found it. Do treat these creatures as though they're going to be older tomorrow than they are today. So I'm an awful Philistine about some of this crazy educational stuff. However, there is one hymn which is an adult I love, which is a child I might not have made much of. Which ran like this. It was written for children by the same person who wrote There Is a Green Hill. Within the churchyard, side by side, are many long, low graves. And some have stones set over them, on some the green grass waves. And a later verse runs, they cannot hear when the great bell is tolling overhead. Referring now to the tenants, you see. They cannot rise and come to church with us, for they are dead. It's one of the most beautiful pieces of obviousness and pathos in all hymnody. Though I'd rather they sang Praise My Soul than that.
I think we can take just a few more minutes yet, Bass.
Reference to vicarage over there reminded me of an experience I had on vicarage. We were in a congregation for many of the people, the majority were not of German background, and many did not grow up in Lutheran homes. And the comment was often heard, oh, we don't like these German hymns, they're too hard to sing, we like these English hymns. Those are... Now, I don't claim to know really much about music at all, except how to sing the hymn, and I grew up knowing them. couldn't tell if one was harder than another. Can I get your opinion on if
yeah.
there really is a difference?
Yes, there is. And actually, the comment that you have quoted was a very discerning one. Lutheran tunes are difficult. Because, as I said, they were devised for a dispensation in which people would be singing them probably every Sunday, and therefore would get hold of them. Where we try not to repeat a hymn more than once a year, that is to say, to sing a hymn more than twice a year, it's very difficult to pick these things up. The English tunes are often common meter and can be picked up by unmusical people as they go along. Well, now, you may say, I don't care. Nobody said that religion was supposed to be easy, and I couldn't possibly agree more. But it is considered just as a value judgment without any moral content. It is, in fact, much easier to sing the English tune to while shepherds watch than it is to sing Luther's tune, A Mighty Fortress, as he wrote it. So don't worry about this. You will find amongst the English tunes, especially if they're dated before 1750, some magnificent music, which is not trivial because it's simple. Mix that in a congregation of that sort with the Luther material that you still insist on, and the people will be getting a good balanced diet.
Yes, I can't see who it is. Roger?
Yes, Dr. Alley, from your experience, what American denomination has the most enthusiastic singing
knowledge? Oh, Lord! I don't know too much about the Missouri Synod of the Lutheran Church, but that apart, I would undoubtedly say the Southern Baptists. And look what they sing! And there you are! We are sinners. Undoubtedly, you get singing of a ferociously cheerful kind in churches of the Southern Baptist Convention, where they only sing hymns of one kind. They will not, many congregations, if you ask them to sing praise to the Lord, the Almighty, no way. It's got to be blessed assurance. It's easy to get people to be enthusiastic about something from which they don't have to learn anything, and which doesn't change them, but merely confirms them in the way they've been going this last 40 years. So the fact that singing is loud and enthusiastic is not for me ultimate. I've heard very good congregational singing, which isn't particularly loud. I sometimes have had, in fact, in my own church, over there in England, I used to get American visitors sometimes. And they were miserable, because the singing in our church was not noisy. And they thought the singing was bad, because it wasn't noisy. And I had very gently, if they made a comment on this, to correct them about this. The singing was probably very meaningful, because people were singing, though they weren't singing very well. We didn't give them practices, and we tried to give them what they could sing. But they didn't make as much noise as the Baptist congregation would, and neither did the organist, and neither did I. The whole thing was rather lower key and low profile, but it doesn't mean it isn't doing its job. I'm sorry, I don't know if that is the answer you hoped for, but as I say, I would love to be able to say that it was your synod of the Lutheran Church that got the most enthusiastic singing, because if it was so, you undoubtedly have the most professional standard of hymnody of anybody. So if people are singing that with enthusiasm, there's some hope for the rest of us.
The clock has taken us to 11:30, and we do have schedule problems. I should like to thank Dr. Routley again for his enthusiastic presentation.